CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
Yeah, I'm going to put that on Twitter. Release the
giallo cut. It's the original script cut. Yeah, no.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And today we have a very special guest. It's director and co-writer Maxi Contenti, who has done a movie called The Last Matinee. It's on VOD, digital, and DVD on August 24th. Maxi, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. This movie, I always get nostalgic about movies that are set in movie theaters because I worked in several movie theaters for 20 years and worked as a projectionist for a long time. Do you have any experience with movie theaters itself?
No, actually I don't. Just I have a lot of experience going to movie theaters.
Sure.
For sure.
Yeah.
No, like at some point in my life I went like, I guess, 5 days a week. There was some part of my life that I was crazy and just going all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
We've been there.
No doubt about that. So what was your inspiration for this movie?
Okay. I always tell this because, it's what happened was the main inspiration came from its location. It was the movie theater house that inspired the film. So I always get inspired by my personal experiences, my life experiences, and also kind of like maybe it's because it's more practical. If you come from a country, well, maybe all countries, but if you come from a country like Uruguay, like me, it's easier to make a movie or something if you get inspired by your surroundings and what you get available, and locations are, you know, something that gets you inspired. So I was shooting a commercial in this particular movie theater that I knew, and I went as a kid, and looking around with the crew, I said, wow, this place is like, it's calling for a movie, for a horror movie. Just feels like, it feels haunted, right? And yeah. I knew this theater for a long time. So it was... later on that I went back to this idea. It wasn't like right away. I was developing other projects who were that were more dramas. They weren't genre films, although I always had and my heart is in genre films and entertainment films and fantasy, and I always developed those kind of projects. But I was working on another one that was a drama. And it wasn't working out. I wasn't getting finance. I wasn't happy with the script. So I went like, fuck it. I need to do something that's producible that you can, you know, that I can make. And so I need to make a movie that is just, you know, celebration or something that comes more naturally. And so I went back to this idea of a movie inside this movie theater, and horror movie, of course.
Oh yeah. I can tell you, as someone who worked in movie theaters for a very long time, this exact scenario in my head happened before. The killer going through the theater and that type of thing. I mean, it's movie theaters just have this natural inclination towards horror movies and everything. So it's one of those things that resonated with me particularly well. So can you talk about your cast? Because a lot of these guys haven't done very many things. Some of these people are in their first movie, and so how did you find these people?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, well, part of it was a bit finding through colleagues. I like the main character, Luciana Grasso, plays Anna. Mm-hmm. I found her mm-hmm. through, she's from Argentina, and I found her through another Argentinian film that I knew from colleagues from Argentina. And she was one of a few of the cast that didn't have to do proper casting. The rest were all through casting, because I asked her for, you know, give me some work samples. And we met and we talk, and I sort of like, okay, I found my character. I was looking for someone like you, and I kind of saved the place, you know, for her. And I did mm-hmm. the same with some other actors that I knew from working in other films in Uruguay. Mm-hmm. But most of the other characters were casting, and they were teenagers or, you know, like the kid, Franco Duran.
Yeah.
It's his name. Of course, that was his first film. And I was lucky to find him through casting. And also Julieta Spinelli, which plays Angela. Mm-hmm. She sent a video, a casting, like an auto casting, you know, presenting herself. And then we did casting together. And I was very much surprised with her talent, and she only had experience in a little bit in theater, and mm-hmm. and some of the older, more, you know, characters, they had some experience, mostly in theater in Uruguay, but they had some movie experience. But yeah, I was really happy and lucky with the kid and with some of the teenagers and some of the other teenagers. I had to push them a little bit because it was really the first time in front yeah. of a camera. And I had to really push them a little bit in when we were shooting the acting, and just, you know, trying to motivate them and all that. And they were troopers. They had to really, you know, confront a gory film.
Yeah,
and being their first experience, and we were shooting in winter, it was cold, mm-hmm. and all the practical effects, it gets really gruesome, and it's really tough. It's really tough to you know, to take that and being your first experience. But when the acting part of it, the, you know, just talking, all that, I had to, in some of the actors, do some motivation and rehearsing.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that's interesting you say that, though, because I mean, those felt like real teenagers. The whole bit about, you know, the guy wants to go talk to the girl, and the other two mm-hmm. friends are like egging him on, and you yes. know, all of that. I mean, that felt very genuine. I mean, they yeah. felt real. And this might be a stupid question, but the theater itself that it takes place in, is that a working theater?
Well, the one that, you know, sort of like was the inspiration, like the one, because mm-hmm. we used two locations to combine, we combined them to make the fully fleshed 90s movie theater. I'll explain yeah. this a little bit. But the thing was, the one that inspired the film was already closed mm-hmm. when I had the idea and I was shooting this commercial inside. It was working as an art house theater, not as a commercial theater, for a long yeah. time. But it got closed, and actually, once it got closed, we could rent it for the movie. Before that, it was impossible to make this movie, because it was kind of, you know, it was open, and for the Uruguayan Cinemateca, which is like Cinematech. So mm-hmm. it's an organization of art house theaters that is really cool, but we couldn't manage to shoot the movie if they were there. So once they left, we rented the place. And the other theater, which is called Opera, for real. Is and we used for all the exteriors in some way, because the all the interiors are the big one. The it's called 18 de Julio, the main one, which is the name of the main street of Montevideo, 18 of July, 18 de Julio. That's the name of the, that was the name of the theater. But the opera was the marquees, the exteriors, the ticket booth, the stairs with all the movie posters, the popcorn machine area, and all that was this other theater that it was actually, it's the last working old theater in the city.
Oh, wow.
Like a very throwback, kind of, yeah. Like, you know, inside a gallery. And it hold up very much so as it was in the 90s. We had to do, you know, some changes and, you know, do a lot of production design here and there. But it hold up mostly how it was. So I use it and combine the two together. But it was working. We had to do night shoots there because... Mm. People were going to the cinema,
and so
we had some problems. We almost lost that location actually because the owner was a prick. He was really really bad, and so we almost in the middle of the production, he got into a discussion with one of my producers, and he went because he wanted us to arrive. Around, because this was a night shoot and we were going to arrive at 9 p.m. To start prepping, and he wanted us to arrive around 11 so that the people who went to see The Lion King, the last movie of Disney, and could watch it and leave, and they could close the theater. And we needed those 2 hours to prep. So we went like, hey, come on. And we needed to prep and get the gear and then people. And he went, okay, you know what? You're not coming to shoot this movie. And we were on our second week of shoot. So it was like suddenly like, we don't have the second location for next week. Can you come up with something? And I was like, yeah. And there wasn't a ticket booth in the other location. But I knew, because I knew it from when I was a kid, I knew where it used to be, the ticket booth. So, okay, well, we can do it here. And then the whole thing was resolved. The guy called weeping, oh, come, okay. You can come at 9. And so we ruined some projections of The Lion King for some people. We ruined them. Well, because we set the fire alarm at one point with the smoke machine, and people were coming out and saying, oh, this is really nice that you're shooting, but you just ruined the ending of Lion King. Okay. Yeah. And I went like, yeah, sorry. You knew how it ended because this.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah. I remember having a discussion with some guy because of that, and then someone calling the police because they saw stains of blood in the floor, or they saw some corpse in the floor because we had one and just someone getting out of the theater calling the police. Don't call the police, it's a movie, we're shooting a movie in a movie theater.
Good God,
man.
So there was a lot of nice anecdotes of that place, and it was a drag. Night shoots are tough for a crew. They're tough.
I mean, man, like, that's a tough situation for both parties. Like, that seems like something where if you're a movie theater owner, you'd want to make sure that the last Lion King got done, you know, before the film crew came in.
The horror film crew came in.
Right, exactly. Was that difficult playing two different locations? Because obviously there are scenes where people have to run from one location and then they're in another location in the next shot. So was it tough for the actors to sort of get back into that headspace once they went to the other location?
I don't know if it was tough for the actors, but definitely was tough for me
Yeah.
Because I was really, I was kind of scared that the timing and all that and the combination, mm-hmm. we combined them through a curtain mm-hmm. door. You can see it in the movie. Once the stairs are one location, and then there's a curtain, and that's the other location. But I was really worried that I couldn't, make the timing of all the scenes, because there's a lot of, different scenes going on at the same time. All the characters are kind of like separated in this movie. So it's always parallel editing continuously. There's the scenes of the main character in the projection booth, and then we go back to the theater, and the couple is talking, and then you go to the teenagers, and then you go and see the killer that is moving, and then you go back to the projection booth, and then you... And so it was kind of like a nightmare for editing and getting the timing right. For me, that was the tough part. I don't remember any actor complaining about the location mm-hmm. change. They did that. And some of the actors pretty much stayed in one location.
Right,
some of
right.
them. Some of them are mostly in one location.
Yeah.
Right on.
I love the score too. I think the 80s electronic score is back. Can you talk about your composer for a second and how you came to get to this soundtrack?
Yes. Hernan Gonzalez was the composer for the original score. Mm-hmm. I worked with him before. He also did the Silent House score. Maybe you know mm-hmm. that you heard of this Ryan film. And I worked with him before and all, and he really got me. He told me he was really inspired by the film. Once he got the images and he got the editing, he said, I'm getting ideas, and so I'm very much into the combination of music and film. I'm mm-hmm. actually my inspiration comes from music. It's kind of like the other part of film that I love as much as images. So it's very important for me. And this one is a really musical kind of movie. So for me, it was really important to get this score that also, in a way, tells the story. And there's a theme for the one type of character. There's another theme for the villain and all that. So I gave him a lot of examples, some little things that I also worked on myself for inspiration, because I really like just working it out myself too. Some electronic part of it, but then he had to do the more orchestral classical score.
Yeah.
And the other part was I had this theme. I had this music by Power Glove, which is the theme is called Motorcycle Cop. And I knew this theme for a long time, for a really long time. Once I was developing the project, I sort of like I got hooked on making it sort of like the main melody theme of the movie in a way. Mm-hmm. I got really hooked about it. So I had to work that out with Hernan, and that was good. But I also in a way because I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to use this theme. At the end, I was lucky, and yeah, I could work it out. But there was one point where Hernan he did this score for one of the scenes, and I went. I think I had to bring back the Power Glove, the music here, and he went like, I don't like that. I'm not sure about that. and I say, I love that part you did with the score and all that, but I think I had to bring it back because it's kind of like the melody and it plays with your part. And I think it works. And I had to bring it back. And he went, okay, do it. You're the director. And I did it. and sort of like, so there's a little piece of the score that maybe comes out once we take the, if we edit the score, the original score, we can show that because I changed it for a little bit of the Power Glove. He was okay with it at the end, but I think he still thinks his score for that scene was better.
It reminds me a little bit of the discussion that went on during, was it, it was, I think it was Thor. What is it? Was one of the Thor movies that played the Led Zeppelin song, the Immigrant song, and the composer? I think it was Mark Mothersbaugh. Was like, I like what I wrote, what I did for this scene, and they wanted to do that Led Zeppelin Immigrant song. And really wanted to do it, but that's an always an interesting argument. I would say, like, do I play the existing music or do I play the guy that I picked his music? The one thing about this movie that a lot of cinephiles will see are all the posters that are set, that are thrown around on the walls and everything, and the video cassettes and everything. Are a lot of these movies some of your like all time favorites, or was that just sort of you just found some cool posters and threw them up on the wall?
No. They are. Thoroughly researched and on purpose, and I was really I asked for my production design to withhold me of abusing as much as I wanted to just connect and making this House of Mirrors movie within the movie with all my love for film all over the walls. So it could got worse if it wasn't for the great production designer that I had, that I gave her my Cristina Nigres, her name. I gave her some of my movie reference and my poster collection, and some of the posters we came out with movies invented in a way, in like an alternative reality of movies that are kind of like reference to other movies. So you can see like a RoboCop mock-up that it was for RoboCop. Yes. And then you can see, but it's called Policía Robot, which is like
right
police.
Yeah,
so awesome.
Police robot.
So great.
And then so we had this great designer doing mock-up, a lot of mock-up stuff, and so there's a combination of real things, of course a lot of my personal favorites and inspirations, not the ones that usually people picked up actually, which is funny, and some are so it's a mix up. So there's that part, and then the and then there's so some they're there because they service the story, or maybe they're connected with some aspect of the movie, like well, there's a very notorious Argento poster of opera. And I mentioned this because there's, I love, of course I love Giallo, I love Argento, but it wasn't that I wanted to put that specific poster because of that specific movie of Argento. It was because that movie was going, at one point it was going to be the movie within the movie that was going to be projected, but that didn't work out and we had to change the movie. And so the poster was there because because of that idea, and also because the movie house was called Opera, and I found funny to connect the giallo and the opera and the name of the movie theater with the movie's name.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that, oh, this is my favorite giallo or Argento film. It's cool, and I like it a lot, but it wasn't my favorite. But I, if I had to point some of them, which are really interested, it's I placed some small ones. There's some Raimi posters around.
Yep.
Like you can see some Raimi. There's some Terry Gilliam going around. There's the Monty Python's God of the Monty Python's Meaning of Life. You can find that one. And The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which is kind of like my favorite film from my childhood.
Oh, really?
So it's cool. Over there. And there's a lot of there's a lot of Spielberg references. There's an Amazing Stories poster, really rare one.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to catch. It's in the master shot of the projection booth. And so many. And some of them we actually found them on the theater when we were doing the scouting. We found really old posters, like The Year of the Dragon, which is called in Spanish Manhattan Sur, the Michael Ciamino poster.
Yeah.
We found it, like an archaeological find. We found some others that you can see in the back of the projection when they are running behind the screen. Those posters that you see there, there's a Home Alone 2 poster that's over there. There's a Crocodile Dundee marquee with Crocodile Dundee's head chopped off. Really hard to find, but it's there.
I wondered what that one was. I was like, what is that from? I couldn't figure it out.
So it's a minefield of for movie buff. It's filled with Easter eggs and all sorts of funny references.
Yeah, it's beautiful, sure, and I love sure. Here in the United States, we generally see the same posters over and over and over again, and it's great to see. How the posters look in other countries and everything. And you have an Indiana Jones Temple of Doom in there, and that was really cool looking. And I really enjoy that stuff. It really sort of made a nice world out of your movie theater, seeing all those posters and video cassette and everything set up.
There's actually some Uruguayan movies from the 90s. And some Argentinian films. There's some anachronism too. I placed some posters that are from movies that are kind of like set up in the 90s, but they're movies that were made later on. Mm-hmm. The movie that is being projected, The Frankenstein Day of the Beast, which is the movie directed by the actor playing the killer, Ricardo Islas.
Oh, really?
It's the actor playing the killer is the director of the movie within the movie, and that movie is from 2011, but it feels like an older movie, kind of like a Hammer.
Sure does.
Horror film, and he's the horror pioneer from Uruguay, Ricardo Islas. I connected that, and there's other posters from his movies of the 90s from Uruguay. There's a Plenilunio poster on the stairs, and there's his famous movie. It's a werewolf movie he did in the 90s in Uruguay. Mm-hmm. And then there's another one really famous from the 90s, El Dirigible. It's a really famous movie from Uruguay. And there's a Plaga Zombie poster, which is the first zombie movie from Argentina, and they're friends of mine that I wanted to place the poster of them. It's there. Yeah. And that movie's from 2001. But it feels like a 90s movie, very much
right.
So. It's kind of like set in the 90s. So it's all good.
Go ahead, Chris.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, John.
Well, I was just going to say, when I was watching this and I hadn't read up on everything, I assumed you had shot the footage that you were showing in the theater, like the movie within the movie, because I know that happens sometimes. And then that was fascinating to find out that it was actually a
like you said, the film Frankenstein Day of the Beast. I know you said you were originally going to do opera. What led you to pick this one once that fell through?
Well, because originally it was like you said, it was written and I was really excited about it. I was going to do a sort of like a horror, an Italian horror little film, like an Italian horror invented mock-up film. And I was going to shoot. It was called La Muerte Jamás Vista, which is kind of like the unseen death. And so it was really relatable, of course, to the script and the story. And the thing was, we didn't have enough money budget-wise. Mm-hmm. I had to do a lot of different changes on the script. And one of the big changes was the movie within the movie, because we tried, but the shooting that little film will take another week at least. And so we didn't have the budget for it. So I came up with the idea, what if I used a real film from the 90s, an Italian horror, because of the connection with the giallo and the style. Let's bring, what if I can manage to get an Argento film? That was the first idea, because but it couldn't be any movie. It had to be a movie that worked out and that could be, you know, relatable. It wasn't that I could pick up any movie. That wasn't going to work if it was any movie. So I started a search. The opera fell through, but then I had this distributor from Italy. I always tell this story. It's a long story, but I had this distributor who gave me a catalog in exchange for distributor rights in Italy for the movie. He gave me a catalog of horror, Italian horrors, and a lot of giallos. So I started doing different edits of the movie with different movies. We have a cut of the movie with Argento's opera, and then I had a cut of the movie. I almost got a cut with Michael Soavi's Stage Fright. But then he said, okay, I cannot give you that one. And so, okay, I say, which one? Because there were like hundreds. So I said, which ones? I chose. And then he said, okay, this five, just pick around these five movies. So I was like, they don't work. And then I went like, whatever, okay, let's go with this one. The other one we edited was Witchcraft.
Yeah.
With the Linda Blair and David Hasselhoff.
It was released here. Yeah, I think it is Witchery here or something like that. Yeah, because I think Scream Factory or somebody did a Blu-ray not that long ago. Yes.
So there's a cut with that movie, which is funny because the scenes change, and I did some different actings for them. So the cuts really change, and it's not that you can just paste another movie. You had to re-edit a lot.
Yeah,
and then that fell through too, and I used another one, which was the last one because at the end. The pandemic started and the communication with this guy was like, okay, whatever. It's not working out with you. So, and the last one we used was Beyond Darkness, a Claudio Fragazzo movie. It's a director of Troll 2, the famous Troll 2.
Yeah, I've never seen it, but I'm very aware of it. Yeah.
And that was almost it. It was almost going to be that one. And at the end, that fell through too. And while I was, all this was happening, I had an ace up my sleeve, which was Ricardo Islas, who he was such, he was really nice. He loved the project when I proposed him to be the killer. And he said, Maxi, if you have a problem with this, because he knew that when we were shooting, if you have a problem, my catalog of films is available to you. And I knew that his Frankenstein would work out. So, but I was hesitant because the movie was from 2010, and I didn't want to do another anachronism. I didn't like the idea of that. But it worked out, and because it's a very independent movie that not many people know, and because it connects in a sort of subtextual way, cinephile way, with the director of the movie being playing the killer here, and all those connections with our original horror pioneer in Uruguay, all that just worked out. And also the movie really worked out because it's a slasher. It's a Frankenstein slasher. So, and it has so many, it has so much more connections than the one that we actually wrote. Actually, there's a lot of foreshadowing that you can find in the movie being projected. Actually, the last shot that you see of the movie before the credits roll on the projection, there's a really obvious foreshadowing right there in the last shot. I invite anyone to check that out. Maybe rewind and pause, because there's some funny foreshadowing of the movie inside the Frankenstein movie.
I need to look back on that. I missed that. The ending shot in this movie, this movie is the one that I have the most questions about. Although it might be spoiler to talk about it, but I'm going to try to see if I can ask this question without spoiling the movie. Is there any kind of message at the end about maybe watching a movie too young or experiencing violence at too young of an age being said at the end of this movie?
Yeah, that's a good question. The one of the main themes that goes through the film, and I had as one of the main themes, the main themes of the film, was the end of innocence. I always mention this because it's one of the themes that I, you know, I had always in mind. It's also, in a way, the trip back to the 90s was going back to a more innocent time, like period of time before the present moment is more innocent and slow, and the 90s were slow. And I wanted to also have that experience of going back to a time that things were slower, because this movie has a lot of a slow burn to it at the beginning, asks for patience of the audience at the beginning, builds up slow. And yes, there's a connection to that thing, especially because, I mean, it's not that I wanted to leave the door open, but it was kind of like, yeah, this story is not over yet. I wanted to give that thing with the character of the kid.
Right.
So it's the end of innocence for him. And in a way, it wasn't actually wrote exactly like that. I pushed it a little bit when I you know, did rewrites and stuff, because I wanted to place something that will continue with his character in the future. And that's the idea, actually. Yeah, if I'm lucky and manage in the future to continue this story out of the theater, of course, if it continues, if that works out, the character of Tomas, the kid, it's really important.
It's interesting just watching him watch this really violent movie in the theater. Nobody really knows that he's there. He's in the front row, basically, and hidden by the seat that he's sitting in. And then, you know, by the end of it, you have Anna character like telling him to cover his eyes and not watch the, you know, look at the dead bodies that are in the actual movie theater. And it's just, you know, it's like, I think that bell's been rung, basically. He's already seen horrific violence at this point. There's no going back. You can't really protect him anymore. So mm-hmm.
Yes, it's the end of his childhood, of course. Yeah. It was one of the main themes of it. So mm-hmm. I wanted to push that idea.
Did you just say 19 themes?
No, main.
No, I was like that. That's funny. I have 19 themes for this movie.
Exactly 19.
I was gonna ask you to name them all and whatever. But no, the main themes. Okay.
No, it was one of the main themes.
right. Gotcha. Jonathan, do you have anything else you'd like to ask?
No, I mean, I think I know we're getting towards the end of the time. You've kind of talked about, you know, the Giallo themes and stuff, which I'm a huge fan of. I also like this because, you know, I think most people always think of that as being an Italian subgenre or genre, and there are a lot of Spanish Giallos out there. Were there any more specific ones that you were influenced by or just some of your favorites? I was just kind of curious.
Well, I'm more of a Mario Bava and Fulci kind of admirer.
I can definitely see the Fulci when I watch this.
Okay. And there wasn't really a specific giallos that I can point as reference because it's more like a combination of that kind of filmmaking, stylistic filmmaking, sort of like horror poetry that giallos have. But it wasn't like I picked up something specific from one movie. It really wasn't, or something like that. Except for Blood and Black Lace, which was actually the reference movie for the movie within the movie that we didn't shoot, but it was there because I wish I could, you know, shoot that movie and do a giallo edition of the movie and project that movie that we didn't shoot.
Another I want to see this so oh, my, bad my now. God.
Yeah.
I really want to see this was, now. No, go ahead. Sorry.
But yeah, no. And what I can say is, yeah, there was a lot of just pretty much, I guess, Fulci sense to it. Just his movies are they're traumatizing. They can be traumatizing.
I guess most people know like the Beyond. I just watched Murder Rock for the first time. That movie is like if you could film like cocaine. I'm pretty sure that's what Murder Rock is. No, Blood and Black Lace though, Mario Bava's, that's
the first giallo.
It's in that conversation for, you know, best giallo for sure. I really want to see your other film. I really want to see that film within a film now. That
we need to shoot it.
Yeah, I'm going to put that on Twitter. Release the
giallo cut. It's the original script cut. Yeah, no. I don't know. I'll go back to it if I can. Of course, I will. But at this point, it doesn't exist. It's only my imagination. But another thing that I wanted to mention also is like I really got a lot of inspiration outside of just giallos, also in Italian filmmakers. Like more like I'm a really huge fan of Sergio Leone, and I like in a way. I like the mix of things. I always thought of this movie as a horror adventure, and I wanted to push that in a way too. Maybe making some scenes visually iconic, and I also wanted to have this expression with the kills and all that. I worked really in making them very stylistically, but also combining not only giallo vibes, but also I worked with the storyboard artist for doing all the kills, that he's really into Japanese anime nothing to do with giallo, but really combining the different aspects of the shots, like animation. Something, but for real. I mean, so it's a mashup. I have to say that. It's not only, I know that it's easy to point out the giallo vibes, and there truly is a giallo vibe to it all over the place, but there's a mashup. I'm very much into just world filmmaking in general. And if I had to say, my favorite kind of genre is, adventure and just fantasy. And I wanted to get this horror fable vibe to it. Just, you know, really, kind of like an 80s Spielberg factory around, combined with Brian De Palma and a little bit of Carpenter. Just put all in the blender and mixed it up.
I would say you succeeded.
Yeah, most definitely. Oh, yeah, thanks. The last thing that I thought of watching this movie is I'm glad you can't watch this movie and care about any particular character in it, because if you do, they might be killed. You have a lot of things that you make it where you kind of care about what's going on in the subplot of the movie. And just when you think that it's like something major, you know, it's like those people get killed. I love the fact that anybody can die in one of these movies, and it's not, they don't have this plot armor around them.
Yeah, I don't want to give away any of the kills or anything, but like there's one moment that I'll just say, it's like this super sweet moment between these two people, and it ends so horribly. But it was so well done, because it's just like you just take, you know, that emotional train right through that whole, like, you know, minute and a half or whatever that is.
Mm-hmm. We may have to do a little spoiler tag on this one, but that's fine.
it was a main idea to just by the last bit of the movie, just have this extreme sense of dread in a way that is also combined with pretty things. It's kind of like really aesthetic, and it's visually kind of rich and colorful. But then, you know, it's not a whodunit movie either. It's not like a giallo whodunit. It's a mystery. You stay with the mystery. It's up to you, the audience, to come about the meanings. It's very symbolic. It's up to you to why this guy or whatever his intentions, what was it all about? At this point, it's a mystery and stays a mystery. But it's I also wanted to push this idea of a sense of dread and a sense of they are fucked in a, just like There's no safety here. This can end up really bad. Once the screen turns red, it's like this can go anywhere. And I like that. I like this thing of I don't know what's gonna happen. at this point.
Yeah,
that's it. I was hesitant, I'll say, to do it, because mm-hmm. but I wanted to do that juxtaposition of also very visually appealing, a sort of like decadent glamour of this movie house in the 90s. It's decadent, but it's pretty, right? It's kind of like Amelie in a way. Just everything looks nice, and then you get these harsh, horrible situations with characters that are just mm-hmm. nice. Come on, they're not. Yeah. I mean, they're not so deserving. They're really pretty much innocent. So it's they're victims for real. This is a fucked up situation and a time limit.
Yeah,
that's what I wanted to mention.
Yeah, we'd like to thank Maxi Contenti for giving us this time. This is mm-hmm. great. The movie is The Last Matinee. It's on VOD, digital, and DVD on August 24th. And this actually was in theaters, or maybe still in theaters. I don't know when we'll come out with this, but how has the theater experience been, by the way?
The theater is, well, it's been only in Uruguay, and it's going to be in Argentina, because theaters just started to reopen in Argentina, and it's been in a small limited release in the US. I think it's been in 6 or 7 theaters in some mm-hmm. locations. And it's been moving around the festival circuit too. But in Uruguay, was really something. It was good. It reopened. It was the Uruguayan film that reopened the theaters last year when they reopened mm-hmm. 7 months later after the first wave. And it did well. We did well for the Uruguayan box office. It worked even with the small capacity, you know, because this capacity was really small, was 30% of the theater available. So, we lasted for 2 months, and we actually went back.
Oh, that's awesome.
Once, because this theater is closed again. Theaters closed and they reopen and they put the movie back. So yeah, it's a movie that calls for movie theater projections for cinemas. I hope movie theaters will call the movie, ask for the movie. I think that connection with the theaters and that celebration of movie theater houses will bring the movie back to theaters every once in a while. I
have a feeling that's going to happen, especially a lot of we've got an art house theater here where we're located that I know that this feels right at home with something they would show, you know, midnight screening or something, because a packed theater audience watching this would be a blast.
Yeah, it would.
Yes. I think that was one of the ideas. Yes.
So once again, thank you so much, Maxi, for giving us your time. The movie is on VOD, digital, and DVD on August 24th. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.